that is his aunt. Yeah, I've got to. We were doing the interview, but yeah, thank you.
But I'll let you get through.
You need to ask concise questions because they go on and on.
Yes, they do, don't they? Yes, I. Yeah, yeah.
Yes or
answers.
No? Yes or
yeah.
No?
Yeah, I've got one. Tish.
We're gonna. Okay. Yeah, maybe. Okay. Never had this many hosts. Not in numbers 4-1. Come down to you.
Great.
They don't bite.
Can we go to Matt? Would you make free sat there?
Yeah,
because then it's people, easier. It's easier to see.
Yes. Come on, girls, make your mind up.
Lily, you're not going, surely. Okay.
Oh, oh.
Well, it's not really.
There you are. Should we start?
Yeah, I'm starting. That's all right. Is everybody ready? Right, okay.
Yeah.
With my practice, I'm actually on the cusp of thinking about public engagement because I've explained my background to you. I feel that that's missing in my practice, and I've had some ideas about how I might do that, probably through objects. And thinking about what you talked about, an opening to lure the public in, I'm making some unusual objects at the minute, and that might be a way of bringing the public in. Do you think it's important to have a reciprocal arrangement with the public? I think it is, you know, i.e. that if you're going to, in effect, use, for want of a better word, the public in terms of you want some feedback, you want some almost data collection, you want some material, that then you give something back. And I've had a couple of ideas how I might do that. Do you think that's important?
I think there are two approaches. I think if reciprocity isn't key, then there has to be a really clear ethics of exchange in place so that people know what situation they're coming into and what they can expect to go away with or not. I think that a lot of audiences and publics don't want to engage.
No.
I think that's really complex.
Well, they won't engage not in the way we want them
to
engage.
Yeah.
Because, in a more activated way. Because, and now it's already a difficult word to use, activation, because you could argue looking is a very active thing to do as well. So it might not extend to doing anything else. But I think there is the dilemma of what the desire to engage, where does it come from? Because I think we do both things. Sometimes our project really inclusive and we bring in a lot of people and we invite people to, and we create the environment where exchange can happen. And that's all very wonderful. It's really wonderful for us right? to be able to listen to these people, to have those conversations, and we can share. But sometimes we make work and we just show it.
But that's because we need to retreat.
Yeah, sometimes you feel, it's also tiring. Oh, we have to talk again. So we try, depending on the project, it's not a kind of blueprint for us. Yeah? And sometimes it's nice to say, okay.
And leave it out there.
But also there's engagement and there's participation. What's the difference? I mean, where are the crossovers? Yeah. And if you generate something that that people input to, you then have a mass of material, of course. And that's often what we find ourselves with. What do you do with that aftermath of material? And that goes back to the first point I made. How clear do you have to be at the outset in terms of what you are generating and what role the participant or the engaged person plays in that material, and what happens with that material, you know, which domains does that material then get there?
Yeah, so what are the rules of engagement?
Yeah. So you really need to be clear about those before you go into a project.
I think, first of all, you have to be clear why you want to do it, because I think...
So am I making you uncomfortable?
No, I don't want to speak just looking at my back. It's not a lot to see here.
But is it audible for you?
It's a little bit more inclusive. Yeah. I think it's really important, first of all, to ask yourself, what is that desire? What is the urge? And then, what do you offer, really? And also, what do you get back?
So what drives you? What's behind your...
I'm really interested in people, my background, and all those things that happened in my previous life are spilling over, and I want that interaction with people. I feel that's missing at the minute.
So you said that was nursing.
And giving something back as well. Somehow I feel that I've still got that need to do that, even though I'm out of the context of a health profession, so...
And what do you think art? Because of course some people would argue if you want the interaction, so you don't need art.
I appreciate that. I think that's important to my practice.
So you see art as a vehicle almost to enable that?
Yes, I do actually.
Okay.
A point of discussion, of opening up a discussion, of a point of entry probably.
So any of the other students who have similar interests?
Can I just, when you say they don't interact the way you want them to interact, they will interact in their own way, how do you want them to interact?
Well, if you, for example, develop a project where you invite people to contribute to conversation, to the making of a blanket, then you set out quite a particular structure for an interaction to take place.
But you're talking about interacting with the work, not interacting with you in that case.
No. Well, in some cases, in our case, it's sometimes the same, almost. It means we take up in our work, we take up sometimes the role, of course, of the conversationalist. Yeah, that conversation, and that what we try to do it in a way that we're not sitting there interrogating people to get content, for example. So we create a situation that we can just do our own business, and it's up to the audience to engage with us. But there is an unwritten almost invitation to engage, and in the documentation, or maybe the things we explain to people, that what we may be hoping for, how we might use bits of that conversation if they're happy with that. And when for example, in the series of the blankets, if we would use particular bits of conversations, we would then, if the text is included, those people will have the blanket at home for a certain period of time.
But it means that we engage in hundreds of hours of conversation that might not be made visible in any form.
We are not hunting for content in a sense.
To get to the artwork, if we're talking about the blanket, to get to the artwork, people have to come through us. So that engagement has to take place first. And someone might say, they don't want any fragments of conversation to be included.
So how much do you get involved at an earlier stage in actually recruiting the people who are going to come to me?
Well, any structuring is done by the organisation. So if we construct and set up a public studio, then we'll work with the host organisation well in advance. So they know exactly what we're doing, what the expectations are, and that might prompt them to communicate with their audience or audiences in a new way or in a different way. Some cases it doesn't. They rely on the same people to come. But we're not prescriptive in any way, other than if we're out on the streets, and we often appear out on the streets in our own, as part of the projects. An early project that we did together was when we set up a fake political party in the Netherlands, and which was active alongside the national elections.
Funny enough, we're going to do a kind of new project with the same museum, building on that particular work.
So we were out campaigning along as a support group for our political candidate. So we did generate new people coming into the museum then, very definitely, so because the boundaries between fact and fiction were completely mixed up and blurred. So people were coming into the museum, which was also the party headquarters, and the museum was dealing with people who hadn't been in before, etc. But that was at the core of that project.
Yeah, and I think
the question of the museum felt it was losing touch with its audience because the museum was having to evolve into something else, and so brought us in.
Yeah, because that conversation, I think it's really important that you not try just to get stuff. Yeah, so I think it's really important actually that you just have conversations. And for example, a lot of our projects don't involve any recording. We resist recording conversation in any way. Also video.
You've got all the ethical issues as well.
Also,
it's to do with the freedom to create open spaces where people feel they can say anything, and of course we're always operating on a tightrope. How much time can we invest in a place and in a location and a context? When we know we're already working on other projects, or we're going, if you go back to the political party, we could have run and stood for election and we would have been voted in, but we didn't because we were already working in Japan at the same time.
Committed enough.
And we couldn't follow that through. So that whole question of documentation as well and capturing is really on what's set down fast and what's allowed to disappear into the ether.
And there's a lot of
allows people to open up.
And there's a lot of things hidden that actually are maybe the most important things, and that are not recorded for eternity or whatever. So that some things happen, and that's fine. And I think that's the in that sense, sometimes it's almost the language you use to describe a practice. So what do artists do? Yeah, they make art. But actually, we do all kind of activities that we maybe call together our art practice, and a bit of that is captured or recorded or through images or so, and we make books or whatever, and other people write about it. But there's a lot of stuff, of course, that we try to reveal a little bit, but that's of maybe even more value. So you could say that art is almost externalization. Yeah,
I had a really big issue with an artist. Is this being recorded?
Yes.
An artist.
So make sure you say their name.
That I worked with in Manifesta. The primary medium for that artist was conversation, and the representation of that conversation through note taking, and those notes were then presented in galleries, sat very well within the commercial circuit. And we became really close friends, and because we had to work together for 5 weeks in the same building, we practically lived together. And I had said really clearly that this was friendship. I was not the stuff of the artwork. And I said something that revealed a confidence between my brother and myself, and then was horrified to see that on the wall of the gallery. And that resulted in a big issue between the artist and myself, who refused to take it down and said that it was then his property because he had recorded.
But it was commercialised. So.
And it was commercialised because there was a big price tag on his work. Yeah. So there were a lot of issues around that, and yet we had like an agreement in this case.
Can I ask you about a project? Is it Life and Death and Beauty?
Death and Beauty.
Where you made the two sort of complementary films.
Projections, yeah.
Yeah. So obviously one was made before that event.
Yeah.
And then the other one was made with material that you collected.
Yeah.
So how did you police what you edited out. Did you have, I suppose what I'm trying to say, did you have preconceived ideas of how you wanted that second relational film to be?
That could have been a real crash and burn situation. It's great that, you know, you've read up on that project, looked at it. For those of you who don't know, I mean, that project is a very sensitive project for us as well, because it was...
It's very personal, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was triggered by Edwin's father's death by assisted suicide in the Netherlands. And then your mother died really quickly afterwards.
A year later, yeah.
And we moved to Scotland.
We lived in Rotterdam.
And it was really to do with that kind of freeing up. Edwin's parents were suddenly no longer there, etc. So, and we were going to go to Antwerp, we were going to go here, and we were living rurally, very rurally in Scotland. And we got funding from the Wellcome Trust in what was then the kind of art science strand to make work around assisted suicide, and originally we were going to be looking at very much at that large gap between Britain's consideration of the issue and the Netherlands. Anyway, cut long story short, we went through lots of iterations. We started making film. We had a guy, main character, came over from the Netherlands. It was filmed in Scotland, etc. And then, as is often the case with us, closer we got to the actual public presentation, the sharper we were about what decisions we were making, and we decided not to show that work. And so we made the new work, which is the work that you've seen, and it was essentially two very big screens in the gallery space, and we started with what we refer to as a still life. And the idea was that we would have still life on one screen and the text work on the other. And I was writing this text work, but it just wasn't going anywhere. And it now, standing back and looking at it, I think it was just all far too complicated. So I was trying to understand the subject, partly through your father's death and our experience, because we were absolutely part of Ben's decision and there with him when he died. But also through then the effect that was having on Edwin, but then me, and you know, all of those things. And so the text just wasn't happening. So right at the last minute, we decided not to use the text and to start the show with one of the projection screens.
Yeah, we've not talked about failure, because failure is part of a practice.
Really, what
artists do their failure.
Yeah, we're very interested in failure. So the still life was set up and photographed in the studio. And it is still, in the sense it's not moving, but inside that photographic image there is a series of photographs that are moving.
A slideshow.
It's inside. And those images are the images, photographs that Edwin took of his parents' house in that very first moment when the house is empty.
Mm. So it became like a more momentum mori.
Yeah.
And although assisted suicide was the subject matter of our initial kind of development, we realized that, of course, it's highly politicized, but we knew that by staging an exhibition around it, and also we had curated the space in a way, we had bits of work from collections, and we had wall drawings, so it was quite a big installation.
Historical artworks that dealt with death, representation.
But we didn't want it to become a promotion of the particular kind of stance. So although we probably have strong opinions on that, but we also didn't want to turn that exhibition into just a kind of really limiting stance. So basically what we wanted to create is a space, also through events, where issues could be discussed
and
acknowledged in some form. Mm-hmm. And we were aware, of course, that it would attract some media, so that happened as well, also in a negative way, because one of the heading of the University of Dundee supports assisted suicide.
That was after Edwin had a really long interview with the main consider it
about it, and to say, okay, this is really personal, this is about our experience, we're not promoting anything, and the title of the exhibition was Life is Over If You Want It, and that was a reworking of war is over, if you want it.
So to go back to that question, we were in the gallery space in another one of our public studios, and we were there every day, and it was the case of that second screen might develop into something, it might not develop into very much. So there was a lot going on because the it's a public gallery within, we wanted to site it within our own art school. It's really important to us that it would be with the people that we work with, students and staff. But of course our art school is also part of the university, and it's a university that has very, very strong life sciences and medical sciences component. So there was a very mixed audience. And again, it was just a case of being there and writing and seeing what happened. And so we agreed on a structure that one text, so I was writing in a notebook, and people could see that notebook, it was left there when we were off on coffee or whatever, you know. And we agreed on one image a day. So it was a slide projection, blank on the first day, one text on the second day, and it carried on all the way through, whatever it was, 4 or 5
It was basically a little photographic picture
of the notebook
page.
Was it taken directly from conversation that somebody had with you?
It was taken from a conversation
that you'd overheard.
No, it's all from direct conversation, and always people agreeing to the conversation. What there were overheard components, but they were, that was from material that was generated through many of the public events that we'd organised through the process. So one was a symposium. For example, we had invited an architect that we know, architectural theoretician, and he spoke about architecture on the death drive, but he spoke about it in a very theoretical way, but also the subtext was about his sister's suicide. And an artist that we'd invited who was working on a series of paintings that were looking at the context, the geographical locations of suicides. So they knew what the writing process was, and
they were
happy.
Who were they, just for people's interest?
They were Lawrence Holm, he's an American New York architect, and Phil Braham, B-R-A-H-M. So there were many events like that, where, so that material was Rachel Jones, philosopher, who's now moved to work in the States. That material, I spoke to them in advance about that being matter that I would capture, because that's a really important part of the way that we use text in the projects as well, that the writing also captures and lays fast some of the key aspects. So it's almost kind of shorthand. I think of the writing as a kind of shorthand. It brings to the surface the key points and lets all the other stuff fall away. I use it in a much more structured way than that too in some projects.
But I think what we're quite interested in, although we didn't talk about that in the light of this project that much, but by creating those environments where the exhibition space is not just where you go into and look at the work, maybe, what's fine, but we far more interested in more activated space. So through making, you explore things, and then you show it, and you create environments where people are quite happy. And also, let's be honest, that audience is also filtered, and it's who makes the effort? Yeah? Mm-hmm. So it's often willing to engage, especially if it's not in a kind of very public big museum. But in a kind of less profile context, people have a little bit more kind of time also maybe to engage. So your audience might not be huge, but you have a slightly more dedicated audience that is willing and I can see the benefit for themselves actually to spend some time in that space or to come to the events. So I think what I find quite myself quite really rewarding aspect of our work where you, although it's artists there, of course it's about you and you exploring your stuff and you make your thing and you show it, so it's very in a sense still self-centered, but can you then beyond that create an environment, and by curating bits and pieces offer something that can be beneficial even, in a sense. And it's quite interesting also to think about utilization of the art. Maybe it's an interesting subject.
I read a really lovely piece by, is it Claire Doherty that wrote about one of your publications? And she said that it sort of brought together your sort of research and the practice, but she felt as if she'd missed out on something, that she wasn't there, that she was a stranger. So I sort of got from that that it's the actual participation is a massive part.
That's interesting, because Claire has written a couple of texts, and one of them was for a work we made in the Netherlands, and the title of the work we made was Easing Strangers.
Right.
Mm. So really thinking about that idea of how do you bring people in, and what
sort of skills you need.
Yeah, what are you doing?
Yes.
But there was
one
other thing, just to pick up on what Edwin said, another key thing that we're busy with and concerned about is duration. How, what you invest in a project and how you commit to something. So we talked about that example of not being able to run for election because, you know, we're on the move. But the Life, Death and Beauty, or Life is Over, that project, with the slide projections, that at some of the public events, I think it was the symposium, the Highland Hospice, which is based in Inverness, up in the Highlands in Scotland, they had sent one of their chief executives, Paula McCormack, down, and so she was in the audience, but she didn't introduce herself, but she was really active in questioning during the symposium. She was really great, and we've gone on to work with the hospice through that initial first meeting, and that's really, really important that we've then been able to invite her in a different capacity into the development of the project.
They recognised, actually, what we just talked about, that quality of the practice to maybe that would enable other things to happen that might be very difficult for them to do. So the context gives a kind of safe environment almost in the name of art, suddenly things can happen. So what we're trying to do with them now is the Museum of Loss Renewal is actually the durational project where we slowly move to stages in terms of knowing them better, what they're looking for. But also, they run, for example, all those charity shops, so they have an enormous
across
network.
The islands. Mm-hmm.
And if they want to discuss end of life issues. Mm. And in that part of, and it's the sixth part of Britain, it's a huge area,
landmass.
But for all kind of reasons, they struggle to have proper debates about that subject matter. So they operate in a particular kind of semi-medical context, but they would
but
like
to. But those problems, they say, are trackable back, can be tracked back to education within the healthcare professions.
Mm.
And that they make it, they draw a line between communication and conversation. Mm. And so they're very interested in our practice.
Yeah, and I think, I don't know how you feel about it, but then it becomes really interesting when not the art world, but actually organizations that have totally different concerns can suddenly see something in their practice that they want to work with. Because it's, so I think that for us is a very interesting proposition, and it's a no budget project, so that's fine. So we have to, so we want to move to the next stage. We want to make something that can travel in the region, and almost like a conversation piece.
But we will
then look for the funding, and in that sense. It's a very different kind of relationship that you broker with the museum, this is far more rewarding in a sense, less temporal.
That relationship started in 2009, and it's had with that project we talked about with the projections, and then we started the Museum of Loss and Renewal project, and that's had two manifestations: first a gallery show in the Highland region, and then a second show that combined presenting work and making and a lot of discursive events, symposia, etc., teaching in the Visual Research Centre, which is part of our art school. But in order to get to that next stage, we've we've had lots of conversations with the hospice in between. You know, we might take it in this direction, we might take it that direction, and then things go a little bit quiet. I've worked in the hospice charity shops in exchange for conversation with the volunteers, things like that. So I've been writing, but I haven't published any of that writing because I told them that I wasn't going to publish it, so I can't publish it. You know, and now we're at a stage where we're putting a couple of big funding applications together, so we'll get it on to the next level, because of course we've met other people on that journey who have types of activity and areas of expertise that we really want to bring into the project. So it's becoming a sort of very multifaceted thing, but it needs that investment, and we want that. So we want it to be a slow cooker, because we think that that'll give us a better project.
Yeah, and it makes you also think that you can talk about art in different ways. So you can talk about the artwork in a formal manner, you can talk about why is it being made, or what the intentions of the artist, or you can talk about maybe the therapeutic value of art. And that we are a little bit resist that a little bit, because we associate it with. But it's quite an interesting. I bought a book by Alain de Botton. And I don't know if you know the philosopher Alain de Botton, but he started a school of life. And maybe you've heard of it. It's quite amazing.
You should get the egg timer. Yeah. It's brilliant. And 15 minutes for writing a funding application.
Yeah. So and he and another guy, I forgot the other guy's name, they produced a book, Art as Therapy. And it talks about artworks as that help you to deal with actually, and they've identified a couple of psychological issues almost we all deal with, in terms of identity, etc. And they then go through artistry, come up with particular examples. They also talk about display and how museums are structuring and the taxonomy of collections and how we do that as a timeline and how they are to organize it maybe around subjects or issues in different ways. It's like in the church, which in the church you don't follow a particular timeline. Yeah? It's a particular things come together to enable a particular activity to take place or have a particular experience or a reflective moment. So it's very interesting. The language they use is quite interesting. But so I think we're slowly moving to allowing ourselves maybe also in terms of if we talk about issues of loss, whatever that may be, in a broader sense, not only relate to death, but can you really in an active manner make art work? Yeah? Or can it only be in a kind of more, if it becomes intentional, can you still achieve that? But there is, I think, in terms of, if you want to consider notions of healing in relation to art practice, not only for the maker, maybe, but for an audience in terms of, yeah, spending time with art. I think that there is an interesting world to explore.
Can I just
Posy?
No.
Yes.
Yeah. I cut Posy off where we were talking earlier. So.
Okay.
No, I was just saying I was quite glad that you did, because I wanted to ask you about a couple things, and then I was like, oh, I'm in front of all these pictures.
You want to go behind the curtain.
Not very many people said to me.
Go for it.
There were like five boyfriends that were And I wanted to ask you about, like,
about him.
Yeah, what's this?
I can see your hair.
About artistic differences and what happens when you guys don't agree. And
is that why he's sitting behind you?
No.
You want some advice? Yeah.
But like, I'm really bad about talking about ideas that Joe always tells me off, because he starts telling me an idea and then I'm like, kind of try and steal it and then like make it mine. I don't think that's a very good thing. So I was just wondering about how you guys manage kind of.
Do we ever disagree?
Yes. Do you ever disagree?
Well, we don't have. Well,
disagree on something.
Well, we do. We have different opinions. Of course we do. Yes. We don't have bus stops. But that's a lot to do with really complicated things like having your studio at home and having children around and all those kind of things. You know, so you're constantly trying to mediate lots of different zones at the same time.
Which I think with priorities, probably. Yeah.
I think it often takes us a long time to develop ideas. No, that's not right. I think we develop ideas very quickly. Yeah, so we've got loads and loads of stuff on the table. But it takes us quite a long time to work through those ideas to a point of resolution, to putting our eggs in the basket, because we're constantly negotiating. And that could be exhausting, because it's just a daily, ongoing process.
Yeah, but also I think what to do if life is fragmented. So,
yeah.
So actually, how much time do we, because we collaborate, but how much time actually do we have for creative things? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So often there's so much stuff you have to do, and of course you teach it. It's so many
project
roles.
Project manage.
Your parents. So, also, so all the things. And it's, I'm not complaining. We're quite lucky. But,
but
so actually, with any mixed economy, I suppose you could argue that you actually are part time, and then you have to break up your part time time. Yeah. So how much time actually do you have? Actually. We have the deadlines, of course, that's in many cases, so that will drive at the end decision making. But
I think what
we both feel sometimes, oh, I would love to have more time.
But I think what does sometimes happen is, you know, especially when you're working on different projects simultaneously, like there was an incident last week where I had to. That's a misunderstanding. So I'm in communication with the gallery organisation about what we're going to be doing, and sort of tracking. And then we had a conversation about it, and the blood dropped to my feet because I realised, of course, that Edwin made a comment in the kitchen or something about, so you know what we said we were going to do is. And of course, I wrote the email and I'd said something completely different. So then I had to sort of slowly unravel the conversations and the planning and everything that happened in the intervening months. So things like that happen. And those are interesting things because then, of course, it absolutely crystallizes the discussion and brings you back to the basics of what that thing is that you're trying to do together. So
yeah,
we have moments like that.
Yeah, and it's really interesting, I suppose, that you follow your line of thoughts and you have ideas and somehow you have to, yeah. And funny enough, often they're very similar because you share snippets probably. So
you pick up on stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so there's radar.
Picking
so
up, yeah.
There's a moment where you have to make decisions. And probably if you're on your own, I don't say it's easier. But you only have to have that discussion with yourself.
I don't mean to sound disagreeable. Yeah, I do.
Yeah.
I've noticed about artist couples who collaborate that there's a thing closure, and it's the being two, not one.
Did you say enclosure or closure?
An enclosure. And a kind of a safety.
Oh, absolutely.
And
so
even at points of disagreement, that those close. Because actually the disagreement lies outside.
Mm.
And also the disagreement is threatening, of course.
And it threatens it.
Yeah.
You know, you clump because it's menacing.
Yeah, But also I think we're both aware, there is also danger, of course, when you collaborate. Yeah, that you seal off things in the sense that you become hermetic. Yeah.
Mm.
So that's maybe quite pleasant. So maybe when we talk about the thing, well, that's quite great. But I'm... My fathers, be sometimes really hard actually, to enter that space. Yeah? So we feel it works for us, but it doesn't necessarily mean. Yeah.
Was there art envy when you first met? Did either one of you sort of admire the other one's artwork?
We didn't. Well, it's funny because I participated in Manifesta as part of a group. I was actually at a stage that I was ready to give up art. I was a little.
Yeah.
I went through the whole, very well, museums, galleries, but I reached the point. I felt like I don't know. Didn't feel challenged enough for it. I had many, many questions. So I wasn't happy in the art world. Somehow, I was really asking myself, do I want to do something else? Didn't mean that I wasn't interested in art, but I wasn't sure at this point. if I really wanted to continue with art. So then I was invited or to conversation when Manifesto arrived, and of course that is a big, it was the first time Manifesto landed somewhere with it all ambitions and rhetoric. And then of course at that time it was a lot about the local and the global and et cetera, et cetera. And we felt, hold on, we all artists, yeah, a couple of artists, we live here, but it just make us local in a negative sense. So can we turn that local into actually quite an interesting? So with a couple of artists, we called ourselves Nestwork, and I was also a philosopher and a journalist. So we're quite a mixed group of people. And we said, okay, maybe we, when all those people come to Rotterdam for that particular event, and there's a lot of money to invest in that, can we develop something in a really ambitious way that maybe questions some of sort of what those organizations bring, but also can we maybe bring in all those local initiatives that maybe are seen as local? Can we provide a bridge between that particular organization? So we developed a kind of proposal which we had to defend from the Manifesto. There was a group of curators, and at the end they accepted our plan. So we, during Manifesto, we developed all kind of activities, and we also managed to get a lot of funding from the Netherlands and the city and the Monia Foundation. So we had commission basically. So we developed a whole program as part of Manifesto, as a local group, and not under our individual names. And actually we had some money to do some publicity, but also to create to publish a kind of artist page in one of the newspapers. And I was the one who was given the task to organize, I think, to contact one of the artists we were interested in, and that was Tracy. So that's
wondered where he was going.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. I remember being working, because I was working live in the museum for 5 weeks. It's great knackered, because Manifesto had totally underestimated how many people would come, and there were like thousands of people every day. And then Edwin turned up and he's like, blah, 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 publishers. What? I was just like, couldn't, because I was so hermetically sealed inside my own project that I only went out in the dark, you know, went to bars and then, you know, got up really early in the morning and went back to the museum. So, what happened then? I was supposed to give you a text or something on a disc, wasn't I? Floppy disc days.
Yeah.
So, but it got published. It better, but further.
No, it got published. Yeah. No, it got published. So, then, but then it took us a few days to get together. But then, of course, we weren't interested in art. We got together, that was the last thing we were interested in. Edwin could have painted only black canvases, I wouldn't have known.
But to go back
to quite a long time to figure
out. The conversations.
Floor in the you know, that's how it ends with the artist couple. It's only when they split up. They say, God, that was such shit.
Exactly.
You know, it's like the ex.
I can't have judgment.
We need to wrap up.
Right. So also, they stopped doing the 2-for-1 cocktail.
Oh my God!
We do need to benefit from that offer. We're going to Genting's Casino to the bar for a 2-for-1 cocktail. If anyone would care to join us. But thank you
so
very much.
So we can continue.
Thank you anyway.
Okay.
Thank you.
And if anyone wants to get in.